This is Suit Up Sports.
Suit Up Sports.
Where opinions are as sharp as a tailored suit. No fluff, no gimmicks, just unfiltered, hard-hitting takes on sports and a whole lot more. It's time to suit up. Now here's your host, DJ The Suit Stout.
Welcome to Suit Up Sports. I'm DJ The Suit Stout along with Frank Garcia, 10-year NFL vet. Frank, it's Final Four weekend, baby.
I can't wait, my friend. And I tell you, it is the weekend and so many great things happening this weekend. So looking forward to discussing, talking, cutting up, having a lot of fun, doing that with the games just taking place in a couple days.
Yeah, and you know, the Final Four is a lot like the Super Bowl from the standpoint of even if your team's not in it, you can't wait to watch it. And it's not just because of the games. It's because of the pageantry. It's because of the companionship, having, you know, we'll be cooking again over here on Saturday and having people over and, you know, smoking, Boston butts and all these things. But regardless of whether your team, and this year we're lucky because our team is in it, Duke is in it. But even if Duke wasn't in it, and we can bring up the Super Bowl because we're Panther fans and they've only been in it twice in the existence of the franchise. So, you know, 95% of the Super Bowls that we've watched, they're not in.
Unfortunately,
hopefully that changes soon. But, you know, the Final Four is one of those things that everyone watches if you're a basketball fan. And both of us have been lucky enough to attend one in person. I was at the one that was in San Antonio years and years ago. We did our radio shows there on Radio Row.
Oh, so you've been to San Antonio for this?
Yeah, that, exactly.
So you've been to this arena and everything.
Yep, awesome. I've been to two Final Fours, one in Charlotte and then one in San Antonio.
Okay.
And
which one was in Charlotte?
That was with Florida, Arkansas.
Do you remember what year?
Gosh.
I mean, I hate to put you on the spot.
No, it's probably 90. It was in
2001, 2000, something like that. I think that's when Florida won back-to-back.
It wasn't that. No, okay, it was one where they had the meat hook, the big guy in the middle they called the meat hook.
The meat hook.
Arkansas had Todd Day.
What a great name.
Yeah, Arkansas had Todd Day. And Nolan Richardson was
okay,
their coach.
Okay, okay. Yeah, that's 90s. That's 90s. Yeah,
It was 90s. The 90s. And I forget. I think it was Duke, Florida, Arkansas, and I can't remember the other team, but that was in Charlotte. It was like the first time Charlotte had anything like that. I remember Uptown Charlotte at the time where
was early Charlotte.
Yeah, early Charlotte.
Before it was anything.
Yeah, one ventured
still had
Uptown.
Have a nice day down there. And
that's right.
About two or three bars right in the center of the heart of Charlotte, and you didn't go downtown.
You didn't go down.
Well, they didn't call it downtown. They called it Uptown. You didn't go uptown.
Back then, I think they did call it downtown. Oh, okay. I think they changed it to Uptown when they tried to change the whole persona of it. But yeah, I mean, I remember they had a lot of like temporary bars open up down there, and it was really, and it was at the old Coliseum that doesn't exist anymore.
Pre-Dixie Tavern.
Dixie's might have been there. That might have been one of the first ones down there, but that one was cool. And then the one in San Antonio was Duke, Carolina, Utah, and Kentucky, I believe. And just being as I had never been to Texas at that time, San Antonio, great town, the Riverwalk, which for those of you that don't know, there's a river that runs right through uptown or right through or whatever
it's a
they
beautiful
call it.
Beautiful
city. Beautiful.
Very similar to Charlotte, very similar to Phoenix.
Except normally it's like 178 degrees there. But the Riverwalk is cool. Restaurants and bars all along it. And we had a great time broadcasting from there. If I'm not mistaken, that championship ended up being Carolina and Kentucky or Utah, maybe. I think it was maybe Keith Van Horn, Utah. My brain shot.
That's a way back.
Way back. But
I can't remember yesterday.
Yeah, it was a long time ago. But going to a Final Four, it was great. And like we talked about last show, how just going to college games in general. But this Final Four is really interesting because if you go by the KenPom numbers and those things, we have four of the top 10 best teams.
Yeah.
Ever
historically,
offensively and defensively.
Well, that just shows you, DJ, how much the game is changing a lot due to, in my opinion, the transfer portal and the NIL. You know, this year, unlike any other year, there was only about a handful of conferences represented. Why is that? And they're all the Power Five conferences. Yeah. Why? And it's because of you've lost that intimacy, that pageantry, the things that you're looking for with these smaller teams. Pageantry isn't the right word, but you know that love for the underdog, and it's just that's kind of been the theme of the entire tournament. And you asked the question earlier with, you know, why this. Before we start getting into the meat and potatoes,
yeah.
You asked the question earlier. Is it, you know, kind of where this ranks? And you're telling in your in your bucket list of sporting events where this ranks, and it's interesting because, you know, the Super Bowl, I think, is going to rank up there high for a lot of us.
Yeah.
If you have a a team make a big run in an NBA championship and they're there, it's gonna even, you know, add to that. In college basketball, same type of thing. But where does this rank for you as far as, like, you know, best bucket list sporting events? You've been to so many things, and so have I. I've been very fortunate, so have you, to go to Super Bowls. I played in one, to be in a national championship. You've been to them.
Yeah.
You know, the way they do it now, you go to the championship games, big bowl games, NCAA Final Four, you know, national championships, Kentucky Derby. I might have already said that, but you look at bucket list things.
Yeah.
And this is right up there. And I believe for me it is, because of all the things we experience along the way, the highs, the lows, the disappointments, the victories that we don't expect, you know, those types of things. And just think about where we were when we started this a couple months. It feels like a month ago now.
Man, it sure does.
You know, and it's the whole month of March. And I think that's what, for me, when you get to the end, it's like, I mean, this is kind of like you've climbed the mountain, you've done all the work, you've watched all the games, and here we are down to this final two or final four, and you feel like I can see the top of the mountain, and it pays off from all the hard work I put into watching it. I invested my time with it.
You're totally right, and the final four is definitely up there. I mean, my favorite sporting events I've ever been to, and you're right, I've been lucky enough to be, you know, I've been to World Series, I've been to All-Star Game.
I've been to the Masters, I mean.
Yeah, Masters, but for me,
I played the Masters. I played Augusta.
I was offered to play it several times. Turned it down because I didn't want to be embarrassed and kill anybody. But
I got a great Augusta.
That's when I was younger. I wouldn't turn it down now, but when I was younger. But, you know, for me, I think the best sporting events I've ever been to, or at least my favorite, and they all tie into
with everything. With everything included.
Yeah.
You know, I'm talking about the buildup, the pregame, all the things included. And it could be a golf tournament, too. I mean, we have one right here in our backyard. I think they do a great job with the buildup and the things they have going on.
They do. I would say that my favorites that I've been to, they're all going to involve taking my kids, because that by itself makes it a whole different ballgame, right?
You're making the memories. And isn't that what sports is about anyways?
Exactly.
For fans, it's making those memories, building those lasting relationships.
Well, that's why March Madness is so great, is because how many people listening or watching right now remember filling out your brackets with your dad and your mom or your family and their friends? And, you know, I remember a great friend of my family, Steve Eiler, Dr. Eiler. He would do the brackets every year, and he'd make a big board, and we would have a big party, and you know, the moms and the wives normally were just picking by mascots and color uniforms and all these things. And the winner,
and they would win most of the time.
Yeah, exactly. And we would always have a horse contest with everybody. And I remember those memories. And so we did that with my family. And I
can remember those as kids, though, too.
That's what I'm talking about.
Even with your buddies.
6 years old.
Even with your buddies, you've gone on the playground during recess, and you're talking about these, I still got my team left. I still got my team left. Yep. That's kind of where you build your allegiance and your loyalty towards these teams. And a lot of it has to do with your dad and what he pushed you towards.
100%. And now for kids, you know, it's even easier because they have 18 apps that you can do 100 brackets on or bet on them or whatever the case may be. But
you got 8-year-olds out there betting.
Oh, I think my son, you know, it was funny. I was watching President Trump yesterday holding up a list of the reciprocal tariffs. And I thought it looked like a parlay that my son puts a dollar on to win $32,000 and has no shot. He has, it looked just like one. But the best sporting events that I've been to, Final Fours are up there. I took my son Dylan, Big D, our producer, for his 21st birthday. We flew private to the Kentucky Derby.
Wow.
And I had been a couple times beforehand.
Big D in a suit?
Got him in a suit. What? I got a great picture.
Did he have
the
linen on?
No, but he had like a nice blue suit on.
I can imagine that linen didn't last long.
Hair done nice, sunglasses.
Wow.
Drinking bourbons on the way there, mint juleps all day while we were there. I almost got in a fight with some little yuppie that literally I thought I was, you know.
What's a yuppie?
Kid was wearing those shorts that look like they've got like 75 different colors on them. I forget what they're called.
It was 2024. You got to make those yuppies might get their feelings.
Oh, well, I don't. I think even yuppies would like.
Is that yuppie? Let me ask you this: is a yuppie the way you would describe a Carolina student?
This would make a Carolina fan with their penny loafers look just normal.
Oh wow!
Like this dude had, what are those shorts called? They're like, they look like they're patches of 100 different colors.
Oh, not pastels.
Whatever they were, he was wearing those and some crazy colorful button down penny loafers.
Penny loaf, but isn't that what you're supposed to do?
It ain't about the way dressed. Is we sit down and we had great. we were like in the maybe seventh or eighth row in turn four, like great seats. And there were benches, right? And so Dylan and I sit down and we had our...
Was his name Spalding?
I never found out his name. I almost did. But we're sitting there and there was some people in front of us that were taking a picture and they were gathering up in front of us so the person could take a picture of them. So Dylan and I just slid over a little bit so we wouldn't be in their picture.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy, he had about 25 years old, looks at me, he goes, "Dude, that ain't your seat. I'm going to clean up the language. But dude, that ain't your seat. That's my mom's seat."
Oh, he started giving you the business.
Yeah. And I went,
I know. You were sitting right next to him.
Yeah. And I went, I know. And I moved over again so they could take the picture. And he goes, "Dude, I told you, man." And starts cussing me.
Oh boy.
And
you've had a couple of bourbons in you.
Yeah. But I had a lot of bourbon in me, but even boy. But he had probably,
I've seen this DJ.
But he probably had 1,000 in him.
Okay.
And evidently he'd been mouthing off to everybody. Hmm. And so, long story short, I forget exactly what it was he said. Plus, I've got my son Dylan with me, right? So you're always a little more protective when you have kids with
you. You don't want to be disrespected in front of your kids.
Yep. And boy, I could tell you what I said, but we would get kicked off TV. But I went at him verbally. And he shut up.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone in front of me, the people that were taking the pictures, all turned around and said, "Thank you. Finally, somebody said something, this drunk kid, blah, 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 blah."
Oh.
And then about 5 minutes later, here comes his mom. He was with his mommy.
And now you see why.
And she had all of his little things in her hand. Like, literally, she went to go get his little T-shirts and his beer.
Was she still feeding him from the breast?
Well, it would not have surprised me. Taking Dylan to the Kentucky Derby, and flying there private and back was great. I took Dylan and Connor, both boys, to...
So what was the more memorable part? Was it the story that goes with that? Was it the race or was it the flight? Because, I mean, it sounds like, you know, of all the things you described, you didn't even talk about the horse races.
Well,
I have to believe that you didn't even watch the horse race. You were too busy.
Well, the thing with Kentucky
Derby, other ancillary things.
Well, the Kentucky Derby, you know, the actual Derby isn't, it's the second to last race. So you've got, you know, 12 races before. Yeah. And you know, we got there and we go to the merch place and I buy Dylan with all the kids.
You had bougie seats too, correct?
Yeah, we had good seats. And
next to Spalding.
No, we weren't. No, that was the year before.
Oh, okay.
But we had really good seats in turn four. It was actually the first Derby that I've been to that didn't pour down rain. The first two I went to had the most rain in the history of the Derby, both of them. So it was nice to just be in the sun. I had to go buy a hat because my head was getting torched. And Dylan wanted to get something to eat. So he waited in line, it seemed, for an hour just to get a cheeseburger because the lines were so long.
That's what I've heard.
But we're pounding mint juleps and having a good time. That was just the day. We flew back. We landed around 8:30 at night, and we went right to Steak 48.
Oh, yeah.
And a bunch of us had
I remember this day.
There.
We had to, I think I had reminded the person you went with, Bob, that he had won a big parlay. He had won a huge parlay.
It was either that
and day. He forgot it.
Well, no, what happened was the horse got disqualified.
The horse got disqualified.
And because of that, he won.
That's right. That's what it was.
And he did not throw his ticket away, which a lot of people had thrown their tickets away.
But I reminded him or else he was about
ready. You text me and said, "Dude, are you watching this?" I'm like, "No, we're in the car back to the plane." And he went, "Dude, they disqualified the horse." And I went, "Dude, Frank said they just disqualified the horse."
That's right.
And then they would go nuts because they kept their tickets.
That's right.
And I think it was a $6,000 winner.
Yes, it was a big winner. And paid for dinner.
Oh, I think I might have paid that one time. But Dylan and I didn't win crap on those. But that was a great one. And then I took Dylan and Connor to the national championship game in Atlanta with Georgia and Alabama.
I remember
which was the game where they put in two as a freshman.
Yeah.
He throws the bomb to Devontae Smith, two great pros now.
When Georgia started becoming Georgia.
Yep. I also took him to a World Series game in New York when the Mets lost the World Series to Kansas City. But the one game the Mets did win was the one we were at in New York. I almost got in a fight in that one, too. That was a pretty funny story. We're sitting like in the...
Were the boys with you?
Yeah, it was me
and
the boys.
Why does every great story...
I know.
Why does every great story involve two things? Drinking and fighting.
Well,
think about that. I'm going to give you a little, let's do a little therapy.
Do we have a couch? I need to lay down. No, but this one, you know, I'm a Southern guy and you know, I've been up north many times, spent a lot of summers up there with family, but I'm a Southern boy. And we're there, and we had seats down the left field line.
You're a Southern boy with a New York
attitude,
yes.
And we're like...
And vocabulary.
Yeah, it's hard to clean it up. But we're sitting left field line towards the end of the outfield seats, lower level.
The World Series.
World Series. And behind us, there's the concession stands or whatever. But they had like this one section where people could pay cheap for standing room only. And the New York crowd was going crazy. Well, the anthem's great. Everything's going great. And Dylan and Connor were both tall, you know, like even though they were young at this point in time, they're probably 16, 15.
They're big boys.
They were tall, you know. And so
I mean, you're 5'11". They're probably
I'm 5'10". Yeah. Dylan's 6'3". And Connor's 6'4". 6'1". And,
yeah, Dylan.
And we're standing there and we're cheering, right? We're standing up, as is most people. Well, the people in the standing room only, some of the guys start yelling for us to sit down. And you stood up and saying it like mean. And I'm with my kids.
You're
right?
In New York, though.
You're in New York, but I'm with my kids. Like, don't talk like that. And not, you know, and so
in front of the kids, you're berating this other Spalding and,
well, no, but and dog kid, cursing. I also them. Showed my kids that there's a point in time where you do have to say, hey,
no. Only when it's not to me.
Right. Right. Well, the guy said he kept going. Yeah. And then he said something about sit your big ass like that.
Oh, so you're talking to, oh, that's, and you're like me.
I turned around, you know, that's all, and I said, you say one more word, I'm going to come up there and I'm going to break your neck.
You said a lot more than that.
No, I think actually that's all I said. And I turned back around. And then about
a lot more
3 minutes later,
a lot more verbs involved.
There might have been adjectives. And
yeah.
But about 3 minutes later, here comes two NYPD police officers. And
you threatened them.
The kids are going, Dad, the cops are coming. And we were with a buddy of mine, Brian Sudreth.
Mm-hmm.
He was in the standing room only area.
Yep.
And I said, okay, boys, look. This first day.
If they take me to jail.
I
love you, boys.
I said, if they take me to jail, you got Sutter's number. Just text him and he'll get you back and I'll see you at the hotel. Cops come over and they're like, sir, you know, did you threaten that you were going to break that dude's neck behind you? And I said,
these are New York cops.
New York NYPD.
Hopefully they say, thank you.
NYPD. Yeah. And I said, sir, I don't really remember what I said because I was so mad because they had been yelling and yelling at my kids to sit down. And I did turn around and I did yell at them. I don't remember exactly what I said. I might have said that, but honestly, in anger, I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
And he just went, look, have a good time with the kids. Just ignore these guys. They're going to keep mouthing off the whole time. Just don't turn around and say anything to them. You do me that favor? And I said, yes, sir,
this,
I will.
Is this Chicago or New York?
This is New York.
Okay. This is
New York. So we're
because there's a different accent.
I know. And I don't even know what that was.
To figure it
yeah,
out.
I'm not sure yeah. what that was, but I do it. He walks away. We're cool. About 15 minutes later, David Wright hits a 3-run bomb. Everyone's going crazy. I turn around and look at those guys and they're waving me up to them. So I go up there because I could tell it wasn't like an anger. Now they're giving me hugs. They're trying to buy me beers. And it was, and again, it's the only game the Mets won that series. We blew the save in every game that one. But that was a great memory. And again, yeah, I didn't get in any fight at the Georgia-Alabama National Championship game. So there's one that was a great memory without a fight. I don't think I did, Dylan. Did I?
No,
I don't think
no.
I did.
He said no.
But those were great memories. And then the Final Four, the first one I went to was in Charlotte, right? And I did go to some the first round of those with my
were
dad.
Were you old enough to drink?
I was, I think I was. 19? I definitely was drinking.
You're not, well, that's not the
question. But I remember, no, I must have been, because when I was at the downtown bars and we were drinking,
okay.
the temporary bars. Okay. So I must have been 21, maybe.
Right around there.
And Dylan, look up when the national championship was in Charlotte with Florida, Duke, Arkansas. I think Arkansas won the national championship that year, if I'm not mistaken. But
would have been 97 or 98.
Yeah, because, I mean, I was probably still in college or just out.
I was
so
20. I was still in the NFL with the Panthers.
Yeah, yep.
And I remember them coming here. So it was like 97, 98 when Arkansas
was. I was probably just starting working at WFNZ. Like I probably was just interning or.
Yeah, you're definitely 21.
Yeah, I was 21, I think. But 1994. That's it. Who are the 94. Four teams? Florida, Arkansas, Duke, and who? I think it was.
I'm not seeing that.
Look it up while we're talking, but those were great. And the Final Four in San Antonio was great because it was the first time we had done our radio shows and you were part of this at Super Bowls, but we had never done it at Radio Row. And Mark Packer, Pac-Man, the host of our afternoon show, who I produced that show. And then before
this is what year
this, the one in San Antonio would have been probably early 2000s.
Okay.
And
so I'm still playing.
You're still playing.
Okay.
And
I was wondering why I didn't get the invite.
Well,
I got the invite to all of
it. It was just Radio Row. And it was just, we just did Afternoon Drive.
Okay.
And Pac-Man's father, Billy Packer, obviously was big with CBS. And so they kind of welcomed us in. And Pac-Man had relationships in that whole college basketball world, still does. But it was really cool because we got to
who you got, Big D, for the other team? Arizona.
You probably, so you were watching it.
I was probably watching that game, yeah.
And who won, Arkansas? It was Lute Olson's Arizona, yeah. Obviously.
That was a good Final Four. That was probably Sean Elliott, Stoudemire, and those guys.
So. Yeah, that was a good – who was it? Arkansas won? Yeah, yeah. That was the Arkansas 40 minutes of hell team. Yeah. It was the Nolan Richardson. But yeah, so, you know, the Radio Row when we went to San Antonio was really cool. And Pac-Man, you know, knowing everybody and being in that circle his whole life with his dad, Billy, and even his brother, Brant, worked with CBS. They just kind of welcomed us in. So it was really cool getting to, you know, hang out with Jim Nantz and some of these guys as a young kid.
I remember that radio. Really cool. I remember those Radio Rows. And I think that was probably, you know, as working on the radio, some of my greatest memories is that, you know, going to all the different Super Bowls and,
yeah.
You know, you were the PD of the station. And, you know, you had all the shows go and we had a nice little setup. I think my favorite one that I ever went to, there was two of them, the one in Tampa that we went to with Packer.
Yeah.
And I was doing Pack Show at the time, so I didn't even have my own show yet. But it was me, Packer, Corey Miller, and Brenson Buckner. And, you know, Pack loves steak. And
Was that the Ravens-Giants Super Bowl?
I'm not sure. I don't remember who. We didn't go to the game. We were driving back or heading back to the airport.
Yeah.
But the bowl was in Tampa, and on the way back, we were stopping at a restaurant. Pack usually took care of dinner and, you know, did a great job of hosting us and was very appreciative of all we were given to him as well, but always did a great job taking it. So he took us all to dinner. It was me, Corey, and we had these beautiful steaks, and we ate so much food. This is back when I just got done from my playing days, so
yeah.
I could still eat pretty good.
You still
and
can.
I ate the steak, and, you know, we had a nice big meal. All the bread, all the potatoes, all the things that go with that. And then afterwards, you got to have a little sweet tooth. So Corey Miller, who's about 6'3", 290 big pounds, dude. 300 pounds, and he's not a sloppy. He's
a big
he's
dude.
He's rocked up, put together.
Played for the New York Giants.
Corey Miller, South Carolina Gamecock.
Yep. The Reverend.
Yeah, the Reverend. And he still looks like you put it on there.
He but, does.
You know, we both were housing down the food. And afterwards, we said, let's get something sweet to eat. So we said, okay. And we ordered an Apple Fantasy was the name of the dessert. It was called an Apple Fantasy.
That can't be not good.
And, you know, you can imagine all the guys' looks. QCB was there. Buck was there. Pack was there. Tony was there. Hitman was there. I'm surprised you weren't there. I don't know where you were at, but we ordered the Apple Fantasy, and they brought out two spoons for Corey and
I. Oh, Lord. Oh, Lord.
Can you imagine what Brenson Buckner?
Oh, I mean, that made it on the show.
It made it on the show, and we will never live that down. But Corey and I split an Apple Fantasy.
Oh, Lord. Yeah, I can only imagine.
It had the whipped cream and everything, you know, on top.
I think that was the Ravens-Giants Super Bowl, and you're right. Like, normally we would do the shows there all week, and we would fly out on Saturday or Sunday morning, and we would be home for the Super Bowl. Well, I'm a Giants fan, so I was told, hey, DJ, I can get you one ticket if you want to stay. And we had a big RV at the time that we brought down there, and the big unit, and the driver of it, his name was Houston, and I said, hey, look, man, I want to go to the game tomorrow by myself, so I'm going to blow off my flight. Can you stay so I can tailgate at the big unit, because I won't have anybody with me? And he did. I go into the game and I get this ticket, and this is before you had tickets on your phone, right? You had an actual ticket, and I get in there not knowing, you know, where the seats were. Come to find out, my old boss, Mike Kellogg, who actually is going to be in town tomorrow. I can't wait to see him. He was a Boston guy, and he had worked at the sports station up in Boston for a long time. Long story short, Robert Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, had an extra ticket. And that's the ticket I got.
Wow.
And so I sit down, and you know, if you've not been to a Super Bowl before, the chair in front of you is loaded with like a seat cushion. You know, it's got all kinds of, back then it had like a little Sony Walkman, all kinds of stuff in it. So I'm just sitting there enamored by all this because I had not been to a Super Bowl, I don't think, at that point.
Did you
in time.
Have pockets?
I had pockets, but I think I had beers in them. And I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden people start coming sitting next to me and behind me. And Johnny Unitas sat next to me.
Wow.
Evander Holyfield sat right behind me.
Wow.
The Giant from WWE sat like in one of the, I don't even think
he could fit. What row did he fit in?
Oh my God. Like I really don't remember him sitting that long because I don't think he probably could fit in the chair. I remember talking to him up in the lobby area where the bars were, but I'm sitting there and I'm just surrounded by like all these great athletes. And then they're probably wondering, who is this pipsqueak sitting here listening to a Sony Walkman or whatever the heck was in the seat cushion. But
they didn't know you, the state leading scorer in soccer.
They didn't know that I led the state in scoring my senior year. They had no clue. You would think it would travel to Florida. Right.
You would think everybody would know that.
I ended up leaving early because if you remember the game, the Ravens crushed the Giants. But yeah, so, you know, the Final Four definitely fits up with those type of memories. And this one could be the best we've seen. We talked about the portal and we've talked about how there's not been the upsets and the lack of the smaller schools, but the trade in for that is the fact that we've had great matchups with great teams and the portal, like you said, has changed everything. And you know, the portal, now you can't turn your phone on or see ESPN without seeing something portal. This guy entered the portal or this guy is committed to this school. And I'm watching all these coaches, you know, signing these kids in the portal. And it kind of reminded me, I've really never watched The Bachelorette before. I've never watched it, but I know what it is. I've seen the commercials. You can't watch TV without seeing it.
Will you accept this?
Yeah, rose? Exactly. We accept this rose or whatever. But doesn't it seem like the portal now has turned into the coaches or like The Bachelorette? The coaches are trying to go to these guys into the portal and what coach can get a rose to them fast enough. I read a story about Florida's coach, Coach Golden, and Clayton, their awesome guard who has just been unbelievable in this tournament. Some of the three-pointers this kid's making, I mean, they compare him to Steph Curry, and darn it, he's earned it. I mean, he does make – I'm not giving him Steph yet, but he makes shots that we see Steph. I mean, he had a rebound in the last game and literally dribbled it back to the three-point line, and everyone thought he was going to reset it, and he just turned around and shot.
His layups are three-pointers.
Yeah, it's nuts. Well, he was making his final decision between St. John's and Florida last year, and it was Easter Sunday – and Coach Golden flew to his house he was leaning towards St. John's, flew to his house on Easter Sunday, met with his family on Easter Sunday, and he got him. And then Coach Golden had a pretty funny quote. He goes, look, I'm Jewish, so we don't celebrate Easter. So I didn't get in trouble for my family. It worked out perfectly. And so, but you know, that's what the portal's become. It's truly like a free agent class every year.
But here's the difference with this. When you listen to these coaches vent their frustrations and talk about the future of the portal and where this is going, you know, I know you've mentioned it many times, and you're absolutely right. There has to be some rules and regulations, or else it's going to become the wild, wild west, like what we're seeing right now. There's been so many people and players that are being approached by some of these coaches as they're still in season.
Yep.
And you know, you bring big money, big bags of money to somebody, and you say, and you get, and you offer them the world as an 18, 19, 20 year old kid, it's gonna be tough to turn those things down. So, you know, one year you're gonna have this great team and the next year it's gonna look completely different. You're gonna have these expectations of, you know, having some consistency and building a program. With the way it is right now, there's no way you can build programs anymore. There's no way, unless you are just one of those teams that basketball is your bloodline, and you're going to be able to go out there and recruit these guys because of what you have on the front of your jersey, North Carolina, Duke. You go to some of the other schools out there.
The head coach, which
or the head coach, or the head coach that you might think is going to help you get to the next level. So, you know, you're going to see a lot of buddying up. You're going to see super teams for one year, you know, very similar. Maybe what's happened even with Duke is that you see these freshmen coming in, and I think it's just, I think for them, you know, maybe this is going to be the anomaly, because you're going to have some juniors and seniors that are really good players, that have a lot of experience, you know, kind of teaming up to, build a championship. And, you know, with what's going on with Duke right now with these young players, that might be the anomaly to say, hey, listen, it's not just that they're young and good. I mean, a lot of kids are young, but they play so well together, and they're learning how to adjust and adapt. And that's where coaching comes in, and playing to a style. So anyways, the point I was making is that, you know, with this, these coaches were so up in arms was, how do we compete against these? There has to be some rules and regulations. And I can't remember the coach that said it, but he was talking nationally and he said, I've had three or four guys and I'm in the Final Four already approached some of my guys.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's just, there has to be some sort of regulations or this will become so far out of the box that we can't control it.
I think what you're going to see, and I've said this before, and I feel like it's getting closer to this. And Jay Billis, actually, I heard talk about this the other day. It's going to have to come down to contracts. So these kids are going to start signing contracts like they would in any other league, and it's going to be a one-year deal or a two-year deal or whatever it is. It's going to have the money associated with it. And so if you sign a two-year deal with me, you're bound to this deal, and that's going to help with a lot of it, because if you sign a two-year contract, you're there for 2 years. You're not going to enter the portal, and coaches know that you're there. You can't leave, and you won't be able to leave. That's it. You sign the contract, you're there.
Okay, it's great in concept, and I don't disagree with the thought process, but who's going to regulate that? Who's going to monitor that? Because there has to be, if that's going to be the case, there has to be some punishment if you break the contract.
Right.
Where's the punishment?
Well,
because
it's going to be a legal contract. So just like if you break any contract, you're breaking.
Well, I'm going to have a lawyer that has outs and poison pills and things of that
you're
nature
gonna,
too.
I mean, that's going to be up to
who's going
to
negotiate. There you go. Who's going to
negotiate? Why do you think all these schools now are hiring general managers? I mean, they're all doing it. And that's who's going to handle these. They're going to handle it like a pro team.
They're going to have lawyers involved.
No doubt. Because all these players have agents who are lawyers.
Well,
and the schools now have general managers who have their attorneys. So it's going to just be like signing with a professional team. Rick Pitino made a good point. He said, this now is like it was when I coached in Europe. You get a new team every year.
Yeah.
And that's what it's going to be. Now, you might sign a guy for 2 years, or if the guy's going to be a senior and hasn't left yet, you sign him to a one-year deal. If you got a kid coming out of college, like I'll give you an example. Duke has another great recruiting class coming in, right? They've got Carlos Boozer, who was a great Duke player, good NBA player. His two twin sons are two of the top five recruits in the country. One of them was a co-MVP of the All-Star, the McDonald's game the other day. They're coming to Duke, right? They're probably only going to be there for 1 year. Pretty much everybody knows they're going to go pro. So they probably would just sign a one-year deal. But if you're Duke, you would probably sign a two-year deal, but you would have an out if they go to the NBA. There'll always be an out from the NBA, I'm sure, but it won't be an out to go to a different school. Now, there might be a mutual out, right? Let's say you come here and I sign you to a two-year deal and you're not happy and I don't think you're getting it done, then maybe there'll be an out. But again, that's the legalities they'll figure out, but there's going to have to be something like that. And you know, the way that these teams are built in the Final Four are different. You know, Duke has some portal guys that have made a big difference, like Sion James has been a great addition. But then they've got the freshman, obviously Cooper Flagg's an anomaly. You're not going to get a freshman like that every year. But Knipple's been great. Maliwatch has been great. All probably top 10 picks in the draft. But, you know, like you said earlier, this year that really worked out. They play well together. They've got a great coach in Shire who is only going to recruit guys that fit his mold. But there's going to be years when you get some high recruited freshmen that are win every award, that get there, and maybe they're just not ready. Maybe they're homesick. Maybe they just haven't gelled with the team. So it's a riskier way to go than the portal, where you do, and we've talked about this, have a track record of saying, okay, well, this guy played 2 years at Tulane and was a great leader. He's on the dean's list. And now you know what you're getting. And that's why guys like Rick Pitino were only taking portal kids now. The Final Four teams that are in here right now as well, we haven't seen anyone really enter the portal from these four teams. We've only seen, I think, one player sign with one of these teams from the pro. I think Auburn signed one of the really good guards that came off a team already. But other than that, these four teams have been pretty quiet. Now, I'm sure after Monday in the national championship, you're probably going to see these four teams popping up pretty fast, taking some of these best guys out there, because the really good kids are probably, number one, waiting because they want to be on one of these teams. And these teams are probably waiting because they're going to want to see, okay, who's going pro? I mean, Duke's probably going to lose three guys at least, not counting the seniors or Sion James, who's a fifth-year senior. I mean, you look at teams like Alabama, they had four starters that were fifth-year guys. Mm. So he's got to rebuild a whole new team,
same
right?
Same as Auburn. Auburn has the oldest team left in the tournament.
Exactly.
They've had the oldest team in the tournament to start with.
Yeah, and that's why Auburn, I think, you know, they already did just sign this one kid. I can't remember his name. He's a really good guard. And so that does change the dynamic. But let's get to the games for a minute, because obviously that's what everybody's excited about. And let's start with the Florida-Auburn game. And we talked about this game Monday a little bit. These teams are very familiar with each other. Florida has had Auburn's number this year. So Auburn's looking for revenge. The good news for Auburn is Broom says yesterday that he is 100%, arms fine, legs fine, which if you're Florida, that's the last thing you wanted to hear, because he's been doing what he's been doing, hurt. And so now that he's 100%, he's a handful. But a couple guys that to watch in this game that I think can make a big difference. For Auburn, it's Mazzara. Mazzara has been battling some injuries. But when he's on, he is a difference maker on both sides of the floor, I think mainly on defense for Auburn. And he really has not been himself through the tournament. So I think he's a huge key for Auburn. And then for Florida, I think you look at a guy, you look at a guy like, what's the center? Condon, Alex Condon, 6'11". He got torched by Texas Tech. They would bring him out to the 3-point line and they'd go right by him. And he's an athletic 6'11". You know, Florida's full of athletic guys that are 6'7", 6'9", 6'11". But he had a bad game. Texas Tech really took advantage of him, especially on the defensive side. So, you know, he's going to have to step it up and bring his A game on defense, or it could be a long night for Florida. The Claytons and the Brooms of the world, we know they're going to get theirs, right? Clayton, like I said, everyone's comparing him to Steph Curry. Broome has been, you know, if he's not going to be the player of the year, he's going to be runner-up to Cooper Flagg. It's one of those two are going to be player of the year. And he's just been incredible, even hurt. And he's been banged up a lot the last, you know, month or so. So you know they're going to get theirs. But it's guys like Condon or Mazzara that I think are going to be a big key in this game for Auburn and Florida. We both, I know, have been high on Florida all year long. When Florida has their A game, they really do look almost tough to beat. Now, we do think Duke now, the way they're playing, could have something for them, and that's not to take away from Houston. We'll talk about that in a minute. But Auburn's got to hit the three ball. You know, they're going to have to hit their threes, and Mazzara's going to have to be healthy and play well, in my opinion. And Florida, you know, look, they had to beat UConn by two. And listen, UConn had the longest streak, I believe, in the, what was it, in the history of NCAA? I think it was 16 straight wins over the 3 years, two national championships back to back. If it wasn't a record, it's up there. And even though they'd had a down year from their standards, Florida or UConn took Florida to the buzzer.
That's right.
Florida won by 2 points. And so that was a great test for Florida. And then Texas Tech, we just saw, everyone watched that game last week. I told you I was in Newark for the Duke game, and everybody there was watching the TVs at every bar or every little entrance you could find one. When Florida's down, I believe, what, 13 points with 3 minutes left or something like that, and they come all the way back and get the victory. So Florida has shown grit and gut and have had the two toughest games in any team in the Final Four against, you know, two top-notch teams. Auburn, we talked about how they've been okay. They've been good enough for the number one overall seed, but Broome was struggling a little bit with some injuries. And they've just done enough to win. They've played well. They've had, you know, some moments where you wonder if they're going to be, if they're going to lose, and they've kind of stretched it out. So they've done enough, but Florida has been battle tested this tournament. So you know that if they do get down early or even late, they're not going to fold up and say, all right. And Auburn is a veteran team.
And they have the last game to go back to. You know, if you remember the game, I watched most of that game. I turned it in maybe, you know, after probably 6-7 minutes, because there was another game happening that I was interested in. And I flipped over to this one. And when I looked at the game, Auburn was up 7 points. And very similar to the way they started off against Duke, they were on fire from the outside. They were hitting every shot. But over time, Florida started coming back, and you know, I think at one point they were up 15, 16 points. It looked to be a blowout. They might even got as much up as 22, if I'm not mistaken, in that game. And then eventually Auburn started kind of crawling back in towards the end of it. But, you know, 22 is a pretty big deficit to overcome. Florida, they beat them up. They out-athleted them. I don't know if it was just a bad game for Auburn. You know, Auburn had played poorly down the stretch. They played about as well as anybody in the game, but sometimes it's about matchups. And as you pointed out, you know, bringing the big guy out to the 3-point line, Florida has guys that can run by, you know, a lot of guys from the 3-point line, and they have athletes everywhere. And it's just, I think this is going to be a game based on momentum, you know, some toughness. But, you know, again, as you go back to that time that we played you, these are the things that took place. And, you know, maybe Auburn hits a couple more shots, changes the momentum of those games, things like that. But for the most part, I think Florida is the better basketball team. And, you know, as hot as anybody in the country right now. Auburn, they both played tough games. They both overcome some obstacles. Florida's healthy. They have the better shooter, in my opinion. You just pointed them out.
Clayton.
And they have the guys inside that can be erasers. And they're going to take advantage. They're going to play, and they can win any style of game, as we saw when they beat UConn. As UConn tried to slow them down, beat them up, you know, Florida's able to stay in there and eventually get their shot going. But I like Florida in this one just because of, you know, the pass and what they've done. I like their matchups. Broom is going to get his. Mm-hmm. And as a coach, you say, okay, we don't want him to get his points, but if he gets his points, it's okay. Let's not let these other guys.
That's it. Exactly. And with Florida, same kind of thing. I mean, Clayton's going to get his points.
That's right.
But you don't want to.
There's more guys in Florida than there is in Auburn. I think that's the difference.
I agree. And the spread has varied between 2 and 3 points. I'm with you. I think Florida wins. I do think it's going to be a great game. I don't think it's going to be a blowout. I think it'll be a tight game. I think Florida wins by 7.
And that's the other thing, too. I mean, nobody gives credit to the length of Florida because they all talk about Duke.
Yeah.
Florida has some length,
too. They sure do.
And I think the two teams that have beaten Auburn this year were bigger than them, you know, at each position. And I think that's the thing that stands out. Florida is, you know, they're a taller basketball team, probably the second in the last four. And, you know, Duke was the other team that beat Auburn. Same type of game. I mean, Duke and Florida, those games, when they played Auburn, kind of mimicked each other. Auburn jumped out to the big lead early. Duke fought their way back. Florida fought their way back, had a pretty substantial lead. And then the other team was able to kind of maybe keep it within respectable reasons and, you know, respectability when it comes to, you know, the end of the score. But I think I think Florida just has more weapons than Auburn.
Yeah, I agree. I think we're both on Florida, and I think we both think that they'll cover the 2.5-3 point spread. Duke Houston, going to be a great game. Again, Calvin Sampson, great coach. You know, I've been watching a lot of interviews with him this week because with the Final Four being in San Antonio, they're the home team, for lack of a better word.
Is that going to matter?
I think it won't hurt because I do think, especially playing in a huge, huge arena where you can put 80,000 people in, not that there'll be 80,000, but there are going to be a lot of people in there. And I think that the crowd will be for Houston more than Duke, no doubt, because I also think the Florida crowd will go for Houston. I think the Auburn crowd. So when you have those teams there, it's going to be a Houston crowd.
Duke is definitely the most polarizing team in the tournament. And just because of their pedigree and the past, you know, people are going to love them or they're going to hate them.
Duke is if you made each team in the Final Four a fast food.
Yeah.
Duke is Chick-fil-A.
Yeah.
You know, like they're the prim and proper, yep. Very, you know, and you know, kind of little swag to them. You either love Chick-fil-A or you can't stand them. Not open on Sundays. Thank God there's not a Final Four game on Sunday. It'll be Saturday or Monday, you know. And Houston's kind of like the old school McDonald's, you know, with the old arches. You know, they play a little old school basketball, play great defense. They're very well coached. They got some dogs on defense. But the one thing that's interesting with Houston is against Purdue, which was a great game. Houston was in their face, very physical, mm-hmm. on the ball, tough. Well, we've seen teams since Carolina in the last game of the regular season really try to play physical with Duke and try to get up on them and play very physical. The more I've read about this matchup, the more that the analysts that know a lot more about basketball than I do, they believe that if Houston tries that on Duke, they're going to get killed. And it's just because of the height that Duke has and the fact that Duke has 3 or 4 guys on the court at all times that can handle the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And they just
their 6'10", maybe National Player of the Year.
Exactly.
He might kind of, you know, portray as point guard when it comes down to clutch minutes.
Look at the game so far. When it comes down to the end of the game, who did Duke beat before Alabama to get to the Elite Eight?
Arizona.
Yeah. Look at Arizona game. I mean, he pretty much handled the ball the entire mm-hmm. last 2 or 3 minutes. Mm-hmm. And you're right. So Duke, and that's the matchup that just drives other coaches crazy. When they play Duke, they say, man, they're bigger at us at every position. They got 3 or 4 guys on the court at all times that can handle the ball. So when we press them, we've seen how easily Duke beats the press. I mean, it's like 1, 2, 3 done. And that's because of their height as well. But, you know, with Duke, it's going to be pick your poison. I think the only way that Houston wins this game, and again, I'm not taking anything away from Houston. They're a really good team. But I think the only way that they win this game is if they shoot the ball great and if Duke just has an awful shooting night, because you've got so many weapons with Duke. We've got Flag, obviously, Knipple, James, and then the guy that you and I talk about every Duke game is Proctor. If he's on, then Duke usually cruises, because you got a 6'6 point guard, shooting guard, and him and Sion James kind of switch that up. And Sion James is a big dude. But if Proctor's on, because he gets so many open looks due to the fact that you have to pick your poison. So if you're going to choose between Knipple and Flag, Proctor gets a lot of open shots. He's been hitting them, and he's a junior, right? So he's got experience. Sion James is a fifth-year senior. He's got experience. So they've got experience in that backcourt to go along with these freshmen. And look, Duke plays five freshmen. You know, Foster's been getting playing time. Evans gets a little bit of time. But Proctor's the key as far as I'm concerned, because when he hits his shot, they tend to cruise to victories.
Well, I think that was the biggest difference against Bama when they played them. You were at the game. And when you went to the game, the noticeable difference was just the size, of the game and the speed in which these guys played. And you saw that, especially with the point guards. And, I think right now when you look at this matchup, you look at, guys like Proctor, Knipple, 6'5", 6'6", guys that can all handle the ball. It's James, another guy you talked about, looks like a linebacker out there. That's three guys right there that can handle the ball. And then you throw, the fourth in there that might be probably the best distributor passer, has the best vision of all of them, and that's Flag.
Yep.
He becomes a threat any way you pick your poison, because if he's off the ball, he can get open, hit some shots. If he's controlling the ball, now you're going to pay all your attention on the National Player of the Year, which is going to allow open opportunities and good looks for other players. And the guys that we haven't even mentioned yet is going to be the difference is Maliwatch. When you look at a 6'7" guy who's just coming into his own and getting better each and every game, now has some battle-tested minutes as a freshman.
Yep.
If he doesn't get into foul trouble, and even if he does, the backup
has
been really good too. And I don't think that's talked about enough in this game. I think when you look at Houston, you look at Duke, when you look at their five guys, Houston can hang with Duke, I think, for the most part of the game. If they're getting hot from the outside, I think it's been a great game. If they come out cold because of the height and the way that's affecting the ball, the shots, it's going to be a long night for Houston. But the one thing that nobody's talking about is the depth.
Mm-hmm.
Guys coming off the bench, Duke is 10 deep.
Yeah.
Duke is 10 deep. And in a game like this, if we're not talking about if Houston gets in foul trouble, what happens to those guys? Because when you look at basketball in the NBA or in college, your starters have X amount of minutes in their tank, right? But what happens in those other minutes when they're not playing? Who's going to be the person that kind of lifts up the team to be able to, sustain or grow leads? And I think when you look at Duke's five versus Houston's five, it's pretty even. But when you look at Duke's second five versus Houston's second five, it's no contest.
Yeah, and Duke has a luxury. Shire, and he's been doing this especially in the tournament, between Foster, the freshman, and Isaiah Evans, the freshman.
Evans has been instant offense off the bench. The problem is with him at times, if you touch it, he ain't coming back. Well, if he touches the ball, it's going up.
No doubt. And Shire's kind of set when he's in the game. We want him to get it up. So they know that. But what he's been doing between Foster and Evans is he's kind of been putting them in. And whichever one of those guys start off well gets the playing time. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of riding the hot hand between the two. Both guys have good size. Foster's a little sturdier. Both can shoot. But Isaiah Evans is instant offense. I mean, you brought up the Auburn-Duke game earlier, and Duke doesn't win that game if Isaiah Evans doesn't play the way he played. I think he had 16, 17 points. I think he hit 4 or 5 threes. But, yeah, you're right. Duke definitely has a deeper team. Now, Houston's guards are bigger than Alabama's guards, right? So the size matchup in this isn't going to be what it was.
It's not going to be as big a difference.
As big, but it will be a difference, but it won't be as big of a difference as it was against Alabama. And, Coach K kind of came out of the shadows this week. I don't know if you saw. He's been kind of staying back, and I thought it was kind of perfectly timed because Shire was just named National Coach of the Year. He's setting records for, I think, most wins in his first 3 years of a head coach of Division I team. And Coach K has kind of stayed in the shadows, let him do his thing, which I thought was smart. But this week he's kind of come out now with all the Final Four publicity and talking. Obviously he's going to do interviews because, legendary Duke coach. And he as the young kids say, he gave Shire his flowers. And the thing that I like that he said the best is that you don't hear, and other people have said this, when they're talking about Duke now, you don't hear Coach K mentioned anymore. And it's because, but think about it. We really haven't heard Coach K mention that much at all. And it's nothing against Coach K. It's because Shire has done such a great job since he's been the head coach. And you and I both, after year one, we're like, okay, like he's all right, but I don't know. And then year two, I remember there's a couple of times when I don't know. And then, but then there'd be a game where we go, okay, this year it seems that he's put it all together as a coach. Number one. Obviously, he's got a great team, and he's a good recruiter. He was a good recruiter when he coached for Coach K, and that's part of, I think, why he got the job. But when you hear the teammates that played with him as well talk about him, about what a dog he was when he played, about how smart he was when he played, and how they all knew that he was going to be a good head coach, didn't know it would necessarily be at Duke. And listen, Coach K handpicked him, and he handpicked him when he has a tree of guys in coaching with Chris Collins, Wojo, Amaker, Dawkins. He's got a nice tree of guys underneath him if he wanted to go that route. Instead, he went with a guy that had never been a head coach before, and a lot of people thought, what is he doing? And just goes to show you, number one, Coach K knows exactly what he's doing.
When you're head of USA basketball and you see these young players and you know the potential, you know, there's certain guys that have talents for different things, right? And Coach K has an eye for talent, when it comes to coaching and when it comes to playing, right?
Yep.
He can see those things better than a lot of people. You have it when it comes to music, right? You have national awards, you know, because of those things. I have it in sports as well. I have the ability to see what greatness looks like because I've seen it. Mm-hmm. I've experienced it, and I've played at the highest level. So when I see that difference, right, and typically it's just, you know, for me, it's just, it makes your eyes jump.
Mm-hmm.
When guys are watching film, you know, everybody will tell you, you know, when you're watching the film and everything kind of, I mean, these guys are moving at full speed, but there's one guy that's going to make you flash. It's going to make your eyes jump.
Yeah.
Usually that's a guy like Tyreek Hill or somebody like that.
It's funny. I just literally was watching a portion of Greg Olson's, great Carolina Panther and now great analyst for mm-hmm. Fox. I was watching a portion of his podcast this week, and he had Luke Kuechly on
mm-hmm.
and he said, we all love great stories, especially from athletes that were great at their game, like you were and like Olsen and these guys. And Olsen goes, I remember the first time I saw this Luke Kuechly guy, and Kuechly's on the show with him. And he said, I was watching Miami play Boston College. I knew nothing about Boston College. I'm watching because obviously I'm a Miami grad, big Miami guy. And he goes, and there was this white linebacker, number 44, mm-hmm. that was making every single play. And I thought, oh, that guy's good, but I didn't really think much about it. And then he intercepts the ball, and he takes it 50, 60 yards. And that's when I noticed him, not because he intercepted it, but because Miami had a fast team. And the further Kuechly ran, the more distance got between him and the guys chasing him.
And the guys chasing him weren't linemen. That's going to happen.
They were receivers.
They were receivers and running backs.
Yeah, and so Olsen went, God almighty, who is this guy? And he looked it up, Luke Kuechly. And then he didn't think about it again. Fast forward a week or two before the draft, Panthers had the 9th pick in the draft. Greg said he was in the weight room at the Panther Stadium lifting weights, and he sees the scouts come in, and they've got this kid with glasses on and
just like, it looks like Clark Kent.
Yeah, it looks like Clark Kent. And they bring him over to Greg and say, hey, this is Luke Kuechly, and they introduce him or whatever, and that was it. And they walk away, and as they're walking away, Greg called one of the scouts over and said, hey, come here for a minute. And the scout comes over, and Greg said, so is that kid like, you know, is he that good? Like, are we like, is he here? 'Cause we're considering him for like the first pick, like number 9. And the scout goes, Greg, let me tell you something. Not only was he the best player in the ACC on defense, he was the best player in the ACC
mm-hmm.
period. And it ain't close.
Mm-hmm.
He is a can't miss stud.
Mm-hmm.
And Greg said, like, and we really like, he's somebody we may take at number 9, like a linebacker. Mm-hmm. We've got that. Yeah, we might take
him. John Beeson, I believe.
Yeah, Beeson there.
Yeah.
And so anyway, they didn't tell him they were going to take him, but they said, yeah, we're definitely considering him there. And then the rest is history. But you're right. Like, good players, as you were talking about, have an eye for talent that maybe guys like I can watch football all day, and I think I can pick out.
It's from watching so much film over and over again. And, you know, I don't care what sport it is. I don't care if it's basketball. I don't care if it's baseball. You know, baseball may be a little different. You might hear something a little different on the sound of a bat. You'd probably relate to that a little.
Baseball now is really so many metrics.
There's a different sound when guys hit.
Yeah.
Right. When they're taking batting practice, and some guys, it sounds like a sonic boom, and other guys just have good.
Probably like a golf
is a great example of that.
Yeah.
You see a guy go out there that has talent, and this ball sounds differently when it comes off of his club. It looks differently. It feels different. So those are the things that, you know, other athletes that have been and studied, you know, film forever, they see when Luke Luke Kuechly is a great example. I was watching a clip of him today, and everybody else was kind of going laterally. And, you know, they were talking about how he diagnosed plays and things of that nature, so that when he understood the defense, he understood the offense and the set that they were in, and these were the things that they do out of those sets. It gave him an advantage where he didn't have to think. He could just react. And you could see it physically happening when, you know, they're playing the game, is that linebackers on a screen pass, you know, going, everybody's a misdirection one way, throw the screen the other way. And he's kind of sitting in the middle, just playing possum a little bit. He knows what play they're running, but when he sees it and he sees it develop, he fires. And when he fires, everybody else is going sideways and he's the only one, and he hits the running back before, as he catches the ball, takes one step, hits it, fumbles, picks it up, goes and scores. It's just, it makes your eyes flash. Tyreek Hill is another guy that makes your, Marvin Harrison, Larry Fitzgerald. You can go on and on, you know, with guys that you just, when you watch them play, there's something different about the way that they're playing. And these are the best in the world going against the best. So in this game, it's the same type of thing when you see a guy like Cooper Flagg. You know, his eyes make you jump because it's a big guy doing small guy things and looking just as athletic and quick as a small guy. Those are going to be the difference makers and stands up. When coaches see those, they're like, this guy is going to, you know, he's going to be a generational talent. The thing for Houston, you know, getting back to this game, where their talent is in their dribble drive penetration, right? And that's going to be a challenge for Duke, because as good as they are on defense, right, these guys from Houston are going to be able to use their athleticism and their quickness and their speed to get by guys at times. And what happens when that happens? Are you going to put Malwatch in foul trouble? Are you going to be able to hedge off of somebody else and give wide open looks? Conversely, on the offensive side, where they struggle, Houston struggles, they're very similar to what BYU was. I remember if you watched that game against Alabama. BYU, you know, Samson's going to pick his poison. You're not going to do this or you're not going to do that. We're going to take something away and what we think gives us our best chance to win and probably is something that you do really well. We're going to try to take that away. And whether that's we're going to take away the three-point shot or we're going to pack in our defense and allow three-pointers. Houston, and their conference was 12th in their conference because they decide that what they do well is they pack in their defense. And they're going to have wide open looks from the outside, right? So their efficiency, Duke's efficiency from the outside is going to be potentially the difference in this game. If they hit their three-point shots, all right, they are going to run away with this.
I agree.
And this is not like, you know, this the difference between this Duke team and I think other Duke teams in past that we've seen is they were only three-point shots. And if you took that away, or if they weren't hot, they couldn't beat you. This team, they still can beat you by going inside because they got 7-1, 6-10 that you know, are going to be able to take advantage of different mismatches or matchups.
So let's get to the pick, because I want to go back to a football conversation real quick. But Duke, Houston, Duke's favored around 6 points. I believe it's been anywhere.
It's been 4.5 to 6. Yeah. I think it's trending towards six. The question is that the Duke bias coming in where, you know, they have a big following. And it's like I said, you either love them or hate them. But when you
I think I saw like 78% or 80% of the bets on the winner of the entire thing, I think, is on Duke or something like that.
Florida's but the concerning part, I was on the greatest show on turf.
That's right.
The biggest point, spread total in the history of the NFL. We had played them earlier. We had beat them by 2 touchdowns and took a knee on the 3-yard line at their place. And we knew that this wasn't the same team as they came in, but they came out, they clung together. And, you know, that's where veteran players, you know, have a tendency to be able to have a little bit more chip on their shoulder. Houston's going to have the bigger chip on their shoulder, in my opinion. And I don't know. I mean, this game is starting to concern me a little bit because of how much people are patting Duke on the back and saying how well they're going to do. And they deserve it. I'm not saying Duke doesn't deserve that, but it concerns me when you have a scrappy, hungry, feisty team that nobody's giving them a chance. And Samson is having those guys, you know, just kind of fester in that corner waiting for their opportunity. You know, that's the one thing that, you know, that concerns me a little bit about Duke this game. But I still would take Duke.
And I agree.
I don't know if I'd go with the points, though.
I agree with everything you said. I do think Shire will do a good job of keeping all that noise outside of the locker room. I think he'll make sure that Duke's focused. I do think that if Sampson, if the game plan is to make Duke beat you by three-pointers, I think that's a you know, I would see why he has to do it, but it's risky because, you know, Duke's got five or six dudes that can shoot, and the chances that all of them are going to be cold at the same time.
That's right.
Now, they were against Clemson, and Clemson beat them, but you never know. And listen, upsets happen. You know, big upsets happen. You know, when NC State beat Houston, no one thought it would happen. Now, this wouldn't be nearly that kind of upset. The other thing, just to finish up on this, I think Duke does cover, but I do think that if you look at the trend, I think in the entire Sweet 16, the top seed has won every single game.
Yeah. Well, you got four top seeds.
Well, I mean, like the one seed, right? So now you've got one, two. So I think Florida's going to break that trend. I don't think both underdogs would win. I think Florida being the underdog, I mean, they're favored, but as far as seed wise, I think they're going to break that streak. And then I think it'll be Florida Duke in the championship. And if that's the case, either way, we'll be talking about it Monday. I want to go back to football for a minute because we're going to have Brett Hoffman on in about 15 minutes to go talk NFL draft. But you were talking about Kuechly and we were talking about some of that stuff. There's a bunch of buzz this week about Jalen Walker, the linebacker / defensive end from Georgia.
6'1", 245 pounds.
And
that's not very big, people.
Is he 6'1"? Is he 6'1"?
6'1".
I knew he was 6'1" or 6'2", but I do know that there's a lot of buzz about him. And I know that in his pro day at Georgia, when they talked to him, they talked to him about the teams that have shown interest. And obviously he said the Panthers are one of the ones. He was glowing. First of all, seems like a great kid. Everything you hear about him, great kid, huge motor, you know, athletic, blah, 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 all the great things. He spoke very well to the coaching staff of the Panthers. And then Coach Canales for the Panthers was asked about him this week at the owners' meetings and was just, you know, couldn't have said better things. Said that every Bulldog we've talked to says this kid is unbelievable player, unbelievable kid. You know, he gets side to side. He can rush the passer. He can play linebacker. And the more they keep describing, and maybe it is because he's 6'1 or whatever, is that, you know, at Georgia,
he's 6'2", 6'2", 245.
Same thing.
He's not really 6'2".
But he can,
yeah, but the combine for intensive purposes, I mean, I say I'm 6'2".
Right.
When I go to the combine, I was 6'017".
Right.
So I'm just a shade under 6'2".
But still
I tell everybody I'm 6'3". Then.
Well, I'm 5'10". 6'2", 245, can run. You know, he played outside and he played and rushed the passer at Georgia. Didn't rush the passer as much. But my point on him is now most of the mock drafts you look at have him as the Panthers guy, right? So I'm doing some research on him and you really – you can find mock drafts that have him going to the Panthers at 8. You can find some that have him going before then. And then you can find some where he's going 14, 13, 15. But the way I keep reading about the fact that he's in between two positions almost, but he plays both of them well, kind of reminded me of another Bulldog that had a great Panther career in Thomas Davis. When they drafted him, they were like, is he a safety? Is he a linebacker? And we know what happened with him. The thing that I thought was interesting, because we were talking about Luke Kuechly, and that's what made me think of it, There's been two Butkus Award winners on the Carolina Panthers in the history of their team, Thomas Davis and Luke Kuechly. Jalen Walker was this year's Butkus Award winner. Now, I'm not saying that Dave Canales or Dan Morgan, actually, I think I might have messed that up. I think it was Dan Morgan and Luke Kuechly. That's what it was. It was Dan Morgan and Luke Kuechly were the Butkus Award winners.
And Dan Morgan's the one picking.
Exactly.
Ironically.
So, and I will say this, if you're going to trust a GM
at linebacker,
I think Dan Morgan's probably the one. And I'm sure.
Well, it's just like, you know, it'd be the same thing as if, and I'm not a GM, but if I was on a team in the role of GM, I better hit home runs on linemen.
Right. No doubt.
I better hit home runs on offensive linemen.
Yeah.
That's my forte. That's my specialty.
Yeah.
You got to believe that Dan Morgan is going to kind of take the same approach when you're looking at that position. Very similar to why were those guys drafted? Who was the head coach? Ron Rivera. What position did he play? Linebacker.
Yeah.
So when you start looking at people that are going to have input and impact on decisions, head coach, GM, you know, and those two and owner, obviously, and that, not in that order, but are going to have the biggest impact.
Well, and we'll ask Brett about this in a minute, but the thing that's going to be interesting is when the Panthers pick at 8, and Dan Morgan and Coach Canales are both saying we've put ourselves in position through free agency to take the best player available, and so they keep saying that, and I don't disbelieve them, but I think what they are setting up, and we'll find out even more over the next few weeks. I think that if the guy that they really, really want there is at eight, whether it's Jalen Walker or Tyler Warren or Tet McMillan or whoever, I don't think it's Tet McMillan. I think that they put themselves in a position to trade back if they want to.
Okay, Stark's another one.
Stark's a safety. He's great out of Georgia. But the more I think about it, I really do think that we're going to see a trade back. And the reason I think that is because I think they could probably trade back to 12 or 13 and get Jalen Walker if that's the guy they really want. If Tyler Warren is the guy they really want, and I don't know if he is, but let's say that he is. You know Canales loves him, and Canales is an offensive coach. But if Warren's not there, I think they can trade back. And the reason that this is setting up even better for the Panthers right now is you've got a couple offensive linemen now that are moving up the board, left tackles. And then you've got the quarterback scenario. The
Jackson Dart's the kind of
the rumors coming out, and Adam Schefter talked about it yesterday, is that neither Cleveland at two or the Giants at three are going to take a quarterback. So if that's the case, you got Shedeur Sanders at four. The Patriots aren't taking him. You got the Raiders. Then you've got the Jets and the Giants. The Jets at seven. I doubt any of them are going to take him. I mean, I guess the Jets could take him, but they just signed Justin Fields to a two-year deal, so I doubt they would take him. The Panthers are at eight. They're not going to take him. But what they're saying is a team who wants a quarterback could very well be trading up.
Pittsburgh.
Even a team like Seattle,
Seattle is another one.
Sam Darnold for 1 year, or 2 years, but
yeah, they have stopgap guys
exactly
that are making a good amount of money, but you still need to mentor other guys and bring them in. Same thing happened when they drafted Eli Manning for the Giants. Who did they have at quarterback? They had Kurt Warner.
Yeah.
Right. So
they don't have to get thrown right into.
You don't get thrown right into the mix. You have a year to sit and settle and watch and learn from a really good player.
The other team that's getting a lot of talk about taking Shedeur, if he's there, is the team that picks right after the Panthers in our division, the New Orleans Saints. So if you are the Panthers at number eight and somebody comes up wanting that pick to take Sanders, that's even more reason to make the deal because you're keeping the quarterback off the Saints. And then you trade back, you pick up a higher second round pick, which the Panthers definitely want to move up. If you remember, they didn't have a second round pick. It was part of the Bryce Young trade. But last season, they made a trade with the Rams, and they got the Rams' second-round pick, but it's a late second-round pick because the Rams made it pretty far in the playoffs. They want to move up in the second round. So I do think that if the Panthers were to trade back, there's no way they do that without getting a higher second-round pick.
Well, obviously, I mean, that's going to be the case. I mean, there's going to be trade value depending on how far you're trying to move up and what you have to give up. And there's charts, analytics that'll tell you exactly what that equals, right? How many players that is, what round that is. And, that's stuff that they have in their repertoire, in their arsenal, so that they can look at and say, the 22nd team wants to come up to number nine, this is what it's going to cost them. Mm-hmm. And they're going to say first round or second round or whatever it is, future picks, and then we're going to, be able to get their pick. So I don't know what all those things are going to be. I don't ever bank on those things when it comes to draft because those are the uncontrollable variables. The only people that really know are the people that are having conversations behind closed doors when nobody's looking.
Well, and a lot of times you don't know until 10 minutes before it happens,
and
right?
And sometimes
team decides, let's go, let's make a move,
and
let's do it.
And it's just a game of poker.
Yeah.
Right. Not everybody wants to show their hand until I'm forced. Right. I'm bluffing at a lot of these hands and a lot of these decisions until we make that play, and it might be the best bluff of all, and it might be something that is predictable. So I don't know all of those inner workings. All I know is that the Panthers right now pick at
eight.
And if they were to take a player like, the kid from Georgia,
Jalen Walker,
I would be okay with it. If he has impact rushing the passer, right. And I think, Dan Morgan, Butkus winner, is a guy making that pick, as you pointed out earlier. But Dave Canales also has a say in this.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And he's an offensive guy. So when you start looking at, weapons that can help you, I'll love to talk to our next guest about, what our tight end position could be. And I'm making an argument to him of what the reasoning and rationale I would take him. I think he reminds me of Christian McCaffrey in a different position. That has the ability.
Just meaning he's a Swiss Army knife.
Yeah, he can do it all. He can do it all. So
it'll be interesting to know. I don't know if this information is available to us. We can look it up at the break. the NFL owners meetings were this week, and they voted on the tush push, and they voted to push it off until next vote. It'd be interesting to know if the Panthers voted for or against it, because I would think they vote against it unless they think they might get a Tyler Warren, in which case you don't vote against right. it, because then it benefits you. But yeah. I'll say this, and we'll go to break, and then we'll have Brett.
The guy carrying the ball is not the one that benefits you, by the way. It's the guys that are pushing.
Pushing, true.
Are the ones that are the beneficiary. No, you know, again, I mean.
But when the guy's 6'6 and 250 running, it doesn't hurt.
He doesn't hurt. Jalen Hurts, you know, squats 700 pounds, 800
right.
pounds.
Right.
Doesn't hurt. But the three guys in front of them that are creating the apex yeah. are the ones that are getting the push.
Well, here's where I'm really starting to believe the Panthers go, and then we'll go to break and get to Brett. Unless Tyler Warren is there at eight and he's their guy, and I don't know who he is, but he's the only offensive player that I could see them taking at eight. I do not think they take a receiver. I do not think they take a running back. I do not think they take a lineman. The only player that I think they take at eight would be Tyler Warren. Now, there's some
offensive player.
If he's not there, or if he's not their player, I think they trade back if they get a deal that they think is worthy of moving back, right, and risking their guy maybe not being there.
Well, they have to have a trade partner.
Well, and I think they will. I think especially if the quarterback thing happens if the offensive line thing
that
happens.
That would be the best case. In my opinion, that would be the best case scenario. If Shador starts to slide, you'll see some of these other teams that are looking for quarterbacks. And I'm not even sure if you're these guys. I said it before. I'm not sure he's worthy of trading up to get.
Shador. He may not be, but there are, you know, I have the Beholder, and you never know. Because there are also guys, like you mentioned, Dart, and then I forget how you pronounce it, Show or Schoff, the guy from Louisville. But the other name that and I actually talked to three people in the NFL this week about Green, the defensive end from Marshall. Led the nation in sacks, high motor, great size, blew everybody out of the water with his combine numbers, the shuttle and all the different things, like just a crazy athlete. The reason that he's not being talked about right now in the top 10, top eight, which he still could go, is because he had a sexual assault charge in high school and one in college. Both are thrown out. Both he denied. He went to Virginia and then transferred to Marshall. The NFL obviously has done hours and hours and hours of homework on the guy. I talked to three people in the NFL who do believe that have talked to people that he's got a clean slate. The guy addressed it. Green addressed it, by the way, the first thing he did at the combine. I think they've checked it out enough to where they do believe that he's not a risk, that there were some other circumstances, and we won't get into all that. But
isn't it funny how the more talent you have, the less risk you are?
Well, possibly. But I'll tell you what, there's also teams at the same time. Howie Rosen, the great general manager of the Philadelphia Eagles, who drills the draft every year, he I saw an interview with him the other day, and he goes, I don't care how good a player is. If they've been arrested for domestic violence, we won't take them. I don't care what. That does not fit our brand. So there's certain guys that have that. If there's any flags, we won't take them. I mean, you could argue the Panthers last year taking a chance on Brooks, the great running back from Texas, coming off of ACL. Those same guys I talked to in the NFL said their teams never touch a guy coming off an ACL. So everyone has different ideas. But Green, from a talent standpoint, is a freaking beast. If he has a check mark from the private investigators and all the guys that each team has, if the Panthers do have a check mark on him, he would be a great trade down possibility if Walker weren't there, not their guy. But it's all gonna be fascinating. But we're gonna get with Brett Hoffman right after this break, talk NFL draft. We had Brett on a few weeks ago and he did a great job. We'll talk a little bit of every position and we'll be right back.